Out of all the state legislative contests taking place in Missouri this year, there may not be a more high-stakes affair than the 15th District Senate race. And Democratic State Representative Deb Lavender believes she has what it takes to turn a district that includes cities like Kirkwood, Baldwin, and Valley Park blue. Lavender joins us on the latest episode of Politically Speaking to talk about the big issues for the St. Louis County-based district and why she believes she can beat Republican Senator Andrew Koenig. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
It's a little complicated in Bolivar because there is a Parsons family there.
But we also knew that it was important to make sure that we got to where we needed to go.
You know, if you walk in a room and you're getting ready to make a decision and everybody in the room looks like you, you need to stop.
And right now what happens in the United States Senate is as critical as anywhere else in the country.
I really want the state to succeed.
Well, we want everybody to know that we're all working together.
I just worked hard to try to build my name where I didn't have the money.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. Joining me via Zoom, one of the competitors in the highly watched 15th District State Senate race, the Democratic nominee for that contest.
I am Deb Lavender. Thank you so much for having me today, Jason.
So I want to ask you a pretty simple question, because the last time you were on in kind of the final minutes of the show, I kind of asked you flippantly whether you were running for your final two-year term as state representative, and you said yes. This was in March 2019. You eventually decided to run for this state Senate seat. What made you change your political trajectory from running to re-election to running for this state Senate district?
It really was the last day of session in 2019 when we passed the bill banning abortion with no exception for rape or incest. And that I realized that not only was my opponent vulnerable, I had positioned myself better than anyone else had been to be able to defeat him this year. So we can say, especially in hindsight, that was just the last straw on the camel's back that had me realize that this seat was vulnerable and that I was positioned well. So you're right. I had, for 5.5 years, knew that I was going to run for my fourth term in the House. And it was 2 days after session in May of last year that I changed my mind.
And we're going to talk more about the campaign near the end of the show, but let's just dive into some of the big issues that people are thinking about right now. I want to talk about COVID-19 and the state response to the virus. Let's just say you had been, you're not obviously going to be in charge of the COVID response. It's going to be whoever is elected governor. But let's just say you had the ability to change what Governor Parson has done so far. What would be some things that you would have wanted to see differently from state government to respond to the virus?
Well, I think the first thing that we all missed the opportunity for was a mask mandate very, very early on. You and I very quickly discussed the revelations from Trump from Wednesday that he knew in January and February how devastating and deadly this virus was. Had we been able to put a mask mandate in place, I think that would make a difference. I think it still would today. Looking at what's happening as children are going back to schools, especially the colleges, we're expecting college kids to make adult decisions that adults are struggling with today. Had we put mask mandates in place, I think that would have made a significant difference. I think limiting the people who are in an area, I have such empathy for our small business owners, especially our restaurants and our bars. We have not been able to enforce safe practice, which I think now has created a tremendous possibility that businesses won't survive, and that we know that without safe behavior, it becomes just a hotbed for spreading the virus. And we've not done a good job across the state of Missouri in making sure that people adhere to safe practices. So that's something that I certainly think needs to be in place.
I'm going to play a clip now from State Auditor Nicole Galloway, who is also the Democratic nominee for governor. She was at a press conference in St. Louis in late August, and I asked her how a statewide mask mandate would actually be enforced. Here's Auditor Galloway.
You know, a lot of our local communities don't have mask mandates, and so it's possible that you were in places that don't have mask mandates, And if there were, there would be compliance, because typically people do follow the rules. And listen, the majority of folks want a mask mandate in Missouri. There is a vocal minority, of course, and this is not about testing the laws. It is about protecting the public health and ensuring that we can get back to school and businesses can open again. With a statewide mask mandate, it becomes, part the acceptable thing to do, right? It becomes the norm instead of the exception.
So the basis for my question was that I was traveling just for kind of a mental health break to places like Monroe County, Audrain County, and Pike County. And I saw maybe one person out of 60 wearing a mask. And I really question whether the local health authorities would be able to enforce a statewide mask mandate just because towns are far apart from one another. They may not have enough manpower. And even if they did, and I say this as someone who wears a mask pretty much every time I'm out in public, I'm not really sure if that's really a good use of those officials' time compared to contact tracing or, detailing or tabulating whether people are positive or not. So in addition to responding to the auditor, I kind of want you to respond to some of those concerns about the practicality of a statewide mask mandate.
Well, I agree with you that we don't necessarily want people having to monitor who does and doesn't have a mask on. Certainly, testing, contact testing or contact tracing would be very valuable. But we also, because we did politicize this very early on, and Jason, there was a very big difference between cities and rural. Unfortunately, over the last 2 or 3 weeks, the cases are increasing significantly in our rural areas. And so where it may have looked like they were going to escape catching the virus, they are catching the virus today. Had we had a mask mandate in from the very start, had we been able to leave businesses open in rural counties because of the less likelihood of transmission, but we could have put better measures in sooner to keep everyone safer than we have now. And it's just disappointing how politicized wearing a mask has become. I do think as the virus travels more and more across rural Missouri, we will see people voluntarily wearing more masks because they know that's what's going to help prevent the transmission. And of course, testing and testing and testing and contact tracing, which we still haven't done a good job here in Missouri at all.
As far as the school issues go, and I understand state legislators don't have control over local school districts, and even the governor can't necessarily tell the individual school districts what to do. And it's clearly been a district by district decision about whether people go in school, whether they go virtual, whether there's a hybrid. What's kind of your thought process on like what the legislature could do, if anything, to help schools out?
I think it's probably more executive branch, and where neither the governor or DESE, the commissioner of DESE elementary secondary education, have the ability to tell school districts. It's unfortunate that we didn't put together the opportunity to bring people to the table, whether it's through Zoom or however we distance, and advocate for a state plan that worked for people. Each individual school district sat and created their own plan. What if we had been able to offer a template of how to go about doing this? One of my concerns that the legislature should be able to participate in, we still have an awful lot of the money from the federal government for the CARES Act to help people with the coronavirus still sitting in the bank account in Jefferson City. I don't know why that hasn't gotten out to the people who need it. Our schools could certainly benefit with more additional funding to help keep teachers and students safe. We don't have to go too far into the elections, but our local election authorities are complaining that they don't have enough money to buy PPE for their poll workers. And I know we have so much money still sitting in Jefferson City. There could have been, again, a better state organized plans that we offer for the community, for school districts, so they wouldn't have had to sit. We reinvented the wheel I think Missouri has over 500 school districts. We had 500 school districts inventing their own wheel on how to get kids back to school safely. I think the state could have been much more proactive in helping the school districts come up with that plan that works best for their district.
Basically, what happened, especially after COVID hit, was that the governor, he eventually put a statewide stay-at-home order in place, although not right away. But even that stay-at-home order allowed counties to have flexibility. So, for example, St. Louis County's stay-at-home order was a lot stricter than the state's. And you have situations like even the city and the county's orders are not exactly the same. And then you have like St. Charles and Jeffco and some of the rural areas are much looser. So I imagine based off your prior answers that you did not think that that type of approach was the way to go. Would you have rather had a different way to handle the stay-at-home orders? I know this is very retrospective, but it may not be retrospective, especially if the virus gets to a certain level where people may have to re-examine whether there's a stay-at-home order statewide again.
I think in the end, we're going to realize that different counties having a slightly different rule worked for them. What needed to happen in St. Louis City and County and doing a shelter in place is going to be different than what happened in more of our rural communities where they don't live as close. They don't, even when they gather, they may not gather in groups of hundreds versus tens and twenties. But again, without a statewide overreaching plan, looking at how diverse the state was and how we could create options for lower density areas to be slightly different than higher density areas, we're still puzzle piecing this together. And now as the virus continues to spread in more rapidly across the state, from last Friday through I think Monday, we had 4,000 new cases. I think today we are in the 1,500 new cases, or yesterday's data is 1,500 cases. As we're spreading, you could see how if we had a state plan that gave informal information or formal information to different communities, they could see how their piece of the puzzle created the whole of Missouri. Jeffco not having a mask mandate, we know those people travel up to St. Louis. And those may be the people in St. Louis now that aren't wearing the mask when we go to the various stores. So we travel and we get around, and without a statewide plan, I think that's and I'll even take that to a nationwide plan. Illinois has asked people not to come to Missouri. If you travel from Missouri to Connecticut, you're asked to quarantine for 2 weeks because Missouri's a hotspot. And so without even a national plan that may have carved out some caveats that are a little different, I feel like we're going to prolong the pandemic for much longer than it needed to be prolonged for.
Before we go to other topics, it's not a secret that I've had to cover St. Louis County Council for the last 9 years. And part of that is listening to the public forum section. And there's been a lot of backlash against County Executive Page issuing a more restrictive stay-at-home order than the state. And I have to imagine a lot of people that feel like the restrictions are too restrictive may live in the 15th district, and they may not like the fact that they have to wear a mask or that, you know, 50% occupancy restrictions are in place. So when I don't know if you're going door to door. I know you'll talk later about kind of how you're campaigning, but if there are people in this district that do not support a strict COVID response, and they hear like what you're saying, like, what do you tell them? How do you get them on your side and convince them that, you know, maybe there should be restrictions?
Well, I'm not sure if they're adamant in their positions. I'm not sure I'm going to get them on my side. I'll listen to them. I think as a state, as a nation, we missed the opportunity to talk about how deadly this virus is. We created an opportunity that perhaps there was some falsehoods and that perhaps we were making this up and perhaps it was a scheme to make sure we would not reelect the president. And I think some of the people who are adamant about not wearing masks may be under the illusion that this is not a deadly virus. And so it's going to be challenging. And again, we missed that opportunity months ago to get out ahead of how deadly this virus is, to ask the people of this state and nation to do their part to help reduce the the spread of the virus. And so that's what we've missed. If people are hunkered in that they don't think a mask is going to be appropriate right now, I'm not sure that we're going to alter that. Unfortunately, and until they might have somebody in their family or a friend who's affected specifically by the COVID, I had a nurse once wish that she could bring people through the ICU to really show people how deadly this virus has been, how challenging it is for people in healthcare. I saw a physician this morning, saw Dr. Heidi Miller, and she talked about just how much more challenging her days are. You have to think of, what did I touch? Who did I touch? Do I need to wash my hands? Do I need to change my mask? There's just so much more that our healthcare professionals are dealing with on a daily basis. It just makes the job very challenging. And so there may be people we can't alter their minds of, Jason, but for a lot of the other people, I think they are seeing that it is very helpful and very effective at reducing the cases that we have.
We'll be right back after this short break with State Representative Deb Lavender. And we're back on Politically Speaking with State Representative Deb Lavender. I want to talk with you about Medicaid expansion. It ended up passing in August. There's a constitutional amendment in place now. It's not really a question of whether the legislature will or in the state will expand Medicaid. I don't think they have a choice. But I do think that the next step for this issue is how it's implemented and whether there's going to be an attempt to put some sort of work requirement, either through statute or putting another ballot initiative forward. If you were elected to the Senate, what would be your mentality on not only following through with Amendment 2, but if a work requirement proposal came forward, which I think will probably happen in some capacity, would you be supportive of it or would you oppose it?
Well, if we're talking very specifically about a work requirement, I probably would be less likely to support that. We heard this morning an event that we were at that 85 to 90% of the people who qualify for Medicaid are working individuals. So the work requirements that you are attempting to put out there just truly create more of a bureaucratic red tape for people who are already working to continue to jump through to continue to be able to get benefits. We have people who are living with disabilities. We have our seniors. We have people developmentally disabled who qualify for Medicaid. And those are now that 10 and 15% of people who qualify for Medicaid. And to put work requirements onto that category doesn't work because they don't fit into that category. So now you are just really creating bureaucratic red tape to have somebody feel better that able-bodied individuals aren't getting something for free, where we already know today that 85 to 90% of the people who qualify for Medicaid have jobs and are working, and this is the opportunity to give them healthcare.
Now, proponents of Medicaid expansion have said that some of the savings that will come along with it will mean that there won't be like a $200 million upfront price tag. But let's just say that that doesn't materialize and then there's some sort of cost eventually that the state has to put forward. How would you want the state to respond to that? I think that there are ways to do it. Like, you could tax managed care entities. You could tax vaping products. You could legalize marijuana. You could do Wayfair. I don't necessarily buy the argument that you automatically have to cut. But what Republicans say is, any of those items that I just say are going to be very difficult to pass, and they are tax increases. So, you know, no one likes them, even if it's, you know, a product that somebody doesn't use. What would be your mentality if that ends up materializing, that you have to find a revenue source for this?
Well, I don't think it will. I do think there's a small, and when I say small, $50 or $60 million price tag up front. Because we put the first dollar in and the federal government reimburses us 90 cents. There are some dollars. Today, the dollar gets us 65 cents. There are some places we're paying the dollar and we get nothing in return. And so there are many studies across the nation in the 37 other states that have done this, Jason. Within 2 or 3 years, there's not a state that has an additional cost because of Medicaid expansion. The additional cost usually comes in the first year. By the third and fourth year, if you've implemented appropriately, which we certainly should be able to do in the state of Missouri, 37 other states have done it, it ends up being a cost neutral or cost benefit to the state that we actually save more of our dollars for healthcare. Now, should we increase Wayfair taxes? Wayfair is a tax on internet sales. It is only fair to our brick and mortar stores that they have fair competition on the selling of their goods. We are the lowest gas tax in the nation. We are the lowest cigarette tax in the nation. The gas tax, it's our roads and bridges. We have over 100 bridges on an emergency or critical care repair list. We had to borrow $300 million when time was good. Now we're going to have to come up with $50 million a year to pay back that loan in the time of the economic recession. So there are ways that we can generate additional revenues in the state, which I think we need to look at. We've cut education to the bone. We're not repairing our roads and bridges. We're not investing in higher education. There's a lot of ways that as a state we should be investing in our people, and we're not. And those are the sources of revenue that you've mentioned that we certainly should be looking at.
I want to move on to your aforementioned impetus to getting in this race, and that's an abortion bill that passed in 2019 that banned most abortions after the eighth week of pregnancy. As you mentioned, there was no exceptions for rape or incest. And it's currently being litigated right now, and it probably will be litigated for years. I want to play a clip now from when Senator Koenig was on the show in 2019. And if I didn't say so already, he is planning on coming on in October to record his own episode. And I appreciate the senator's time in advance. This was his reasoning for sponsoring that piece of legislation.
I think this is important because the 14th Amendment says every person has a right to life. When you peer inside the womb, all the evidence points to that life exists. And why 8 weeks is because at that point in time, there's a heartbeat. And so literally inside the womb, you have the heartbeat of an unborn child, and you also have, you know, the mother has her own heartbeat. So you have two separate heartbeats at that point in time. And, you know, the difference is there's three differences between a baby inside the womb and a baby outside the womb. You have level of development, level of dependency, and location. And none of those three things determine whether or not you're a human being.
I would imagine that you have a different view of the bill. So I want to give you a chance to explain why you oppose that legislation.
Thank you. I think Missouri is acting on the definition of some Christianity that says life begins at conception. I know that's not all of Christianity. I know the Jewish faith has a different definition of life, as well as several other religious organizations that have different ideas of when life begins. Not everyone feels life begins at conception. And so for the government to come into my physician's office and tell me what I can do with my life and with my challenges and with my body just seems to be such government overreach. And this is inside of, we don't offer age-appropriate sex education. We're not offering women opportunity for contraception. The Affordable Care Act, as it's gone into other states and women have access to contraception, their abortion rates go down because women are able to prevent pregnancies from occurring. So there's so much about this bill that takes away a woman's right for equality. And it is an age-old conversation. At the turn of the 19th century or 1900s, women were asking for contraception, and we're truly doing the same thing today with the Hobby Lobby case and some of the other cases that are coming out of the Affordable Care Act, that we truly are deciding that women don't get to have contraceptive coverage as part of their health care. And this tremendous turn back at least 50, if not 100 years, is just outrageous to women wanting to have the control to live their own life. One of the exceptions one of the points I've always really been fascinated with is we're so concerned about the life of the fetus at 6 weeks that we have now completely disregarded the life of the woman that this is occurring in. We don't care if the woman's been raped. We don't care if she's been made pregnant by a family member. We don't take into consideration her mental aspects, her physical aspects, what she wants to do with her life, and to completely eradicate the importance of the woman who is in a pregnant situation is just outrageous to me, that we have never seemed to consider that life as valuable as the other. And so those are the reasons I just don't think it's appropriate for the government to figure out what and how to sit in my physician's office with me to make those type of critical decisions.
I asked Senator Koenig how his sponsorship of that bill was going to affect his bid for reelection.
It's a polarizing issue. So, you know, in areas like Baldwin and Fenton and Wildwood, you know, they're very strong pro-life. And in areas like Kirkwood, you know, might lean more pro-choice.
So how do you think that this issue is going to play in a district where clearly the differences between you and Senator Koenig are going to have different reactions depending on where you go?
Well, I think that's fair. There are people that have never voted for me because of my pro-choice stance. We do have those one-issue voters, and that is their issue, and they're passionate about it. So I've had people since I've started running for office that will never vote for me because of that issue. I think overall, the senator might be over-exaggerating how many people are truly pro-life with no exceptions for rape and incest. I think there are an awful lot of people that feel that that bill stepped over the line. And then once again, as I've just kind of said, that there's no empathy, there's no sympathy, there's no caring for the woman who might have been raped who ends up pregnant. And I think for many people, even the pro-life issue, that this bill has stepped over the line. And I think where a lot of people may be against personal abortions and would choose not to have one, they also realize that it's not their role to make that decision for someone else. And that's where I think you're going to parse this difference. And I think he might be feeling that there are more people in Senate District 15 that agree with him than with me on that one issue.
So here's why I think this race is so compelling. You have two candidates with two very distinct sets of views on things, and neither you nor Senator Koenig are afraid to express those views, which I think is great on both hands. I like the fact that both of you are very sure in your philosophies and are willing to own it, even when you're in a competitive race. That doesn't always happen in Missouri. And the other thing that is kind of similar is both of you two have really strong reputations of being just fierce campaigners. Every race that Senator Koenig has been in that's been challenging, whether it was against Shamed Dogan in 2008 or whether it was against Rick Stream in 2016, people didn't think he was going to win, and he won primarily because apparently he is a fierce door-to-door warrior. You ran for your seat 3 times and lost. Then you won. Your seat is now solidly blue. You have a similar reputation. So, like, how do you think you're going to come out in this contest against somebody who seems very similarly hardworking as you and is not going to go down without a fight, basically?
Well, it's good to be matched in that capacity. One of the things we have seen, and I'm sure you follow this, is where door knocking is a big part of a campaign, so is raising money. And if I don't have the money to get my message to voters, it's just not possible to knock on every door in a Senate district. And especially with COVID, it just hasn't been possible to do that. And so a lot of the campaign comes down to how much money you've been able to raise to be able to get your message to voters, whether that's on TV, whether that's in the mailbox, whether that's on radio or whatever. So I have consistently out-fundraised my opponent since I got into this race. And so I probably have close to twice as much money in the bank that he has at our last reporting, which was a couple of weeks ago. And so I think that demonstrates that I've taken the edge on him in the fundraising opportunity. We have started sitting on street corners with people holding signs that say Deb Lavender's running for state senate. And so it is our way to get out into the district, to message with people, to have people see that we're there, and to show them that we're working hard to win this seat. Certainly the virus has made campaigning very different. We have a cute item on my Facebook, Deb Lavender for State Senate. I'm not knocking on doors, but I am walking the district. And I'm carrying a yard sign, so you know I'm not an accidental walker in your neighborhood. And if you're outside, I stop and talk to you. And it's been terrific. We are seeing 30 to 40 people every night that we're out. And so it's very similar for me as far as contact with voters, and I'm enjoying that, getting to see the district. There's a marvelous Veterans Memorial down in Fenton near the ballpark that I truly wasn't aware of before. That we have a Veterans Memorial just north of our district in Manchester. So being able to see this district as I'm walking through is just extraordinary, the unique neighborhoods that we have. So yes, we're head to head with some maybe good door knocking ability. I think I've outperformed him in the fundraising activity, and we've got about 54 days left to see what happens in the end.
My only other question is, it is 54 days out. I haven't seen like ads either for you or against you, but I think the attack ads against you are coming. And if I had to guess a line of attack that Republicans are going to use against you that they've used against other Democrats is they're going to say you're soft on crime. You're being funded by, I'm putting this in air quotes, the liberal mob. You know, I think what is being used against Galloway and Jill Shoup is going to be used against you, because I've already seen some Republicans start to drum up things that you've said about homicides and whatnot. What's going to be your response when that comes? I want to give you kind of a preemptive chance to respond to that, just as I'll ask Senator Koenig, like, if he uses that issue, why he's using that issue against you.
Well, we find it unique that we are all lumped into the same category, that nationwide Democrats will be put into the liberal mob and that we're soft on crime. I don't think any of that's true. I don't think my record shows that I'm that way. I am smart on crime, and criminal justice reform has swept this nation and shows that people are just as safe in our communities without locking everyone up. We have so far been able to close a jail, but unfortunately with the Senate Bill 600 that we passed this year that the governor has signed, truly the fiscal impact to the state might be that we will open two more prisons. We have a history in this nation of locking up our Black and Brown community members more than our white members. And until we start getting smart on crime, we're just going to repeat the patterns that we've had for a while. You are right. We are expecting those ads. Again, a plug. And so now if this is Monday, you're going to see on my Lavender for State Senate Facebook page, we put together just a cute, fun video that my team and I did a week ago. There's going to be mudslinging, and we're just going to try to take some humor with us when we go, and to just have people know that that's on the way. So a little bit of humor hopefully will take us through this. We'll be putting out my message of strong on public education, Medicaid expansion. We're working to still have a good message for people in the district so they can make a true difference in who they're looking to elect in November.
Well, Representative, thank you very much for joining us. As I mentioned before, we will be having Senator Koenig on the show in October, because we think it's important for voters in this district to hear from both sides in more than just soundbites. So we appreciate you, and I appreciate in advance Senator Koenig for doing this. For all of our stories, stlpublicradio.org. Follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. How can people follow you either on Twitter or any other parts of the World Wide Web, including your campaign website?
I'm on Twitter at Deb Lavender. I have a Lavender for State Senate website, and then certainly my Facebook is Deb Lavender for State Senate. So we're posting a tremendous amount of activities that we're doing on the Facebook page. You can see us out in which communities we're out when we're standing on the corners. And so we've been pretty active, and our Facebook page reflects that.
Thank you very much. And until next time, so long.